This is Professor Carlson, and this is the podcast for our class scheduled for July 7. When we left off, we were talking about specific grounds for termination, one of which is basic neglect of a child's ongoing needs for shelter, healthy food, and a healthful environment. As we mentioned when we left off, there's an important defense against such a charge of neglect. It's called the financial inability defense, and we're going to be saying more about that today. We begin in our first slide with a case called In Re A.H. It's a case out of the District of Columbia. Let's advance to the second slide. In Re A.H., deprivation of basic needs. This is a case that illustrates what judges and lawyers frequently call the deplorable conditions case, and it involves a kind of ongoing general failure to provide a healthy and safe environment for children. Note that first bullet points out that the District of Columbia was required to prove its case by a mere preponderance of the evidence. In this case, you may wonder, is that not a contradiction of what we learned on Monday? After all, we learned that to terminate parental rights, you have to prove your case by clear and convincing evidence. But hopefully you'll remember that we emphasized that the state has a lesser burden of proof when it's seeking something less than termination. The state can seek lesser forms of intervention, perhaps temporary custody, perhaps ongoing supervision or counseling and services, and that evidently is what the District of Columbia was seeking in this case. You might ask, why didn't they seek termination? And I think there are a couple of answers to that question. Number one, for the most part, termination is only appropriate if you're going to be placing the children for adoption, or the parent poses such an ongoing threat to the children that it makes sense to get this parent completely out of the children's life forever. That isn't necessarily the case or situation in a case like this, and particularly when children are older, when they know their mother, they still have an attachment to her, even if she hasn't been a very good mother. They'll still want to remember her and see her and visit her as they grow older. Moreover, there's not much likelihood that these older children could ever be adopted because, sadly, it's not likely that prospective adoptive parents will want to adopt children who are this old. And the fact is, adoptive placements of older children have a fairly high rate of failure. So in many instances, the better course is to maintain some kind of a relationship between the parties, the parents and the children, and seek some other arrangement for the children. Typically, it's not a good one. We've talked about how bad foster care can be. Certainly, institutionalized care can be pretty bad. But we have to remember that there are times when simply leaving the children unsupervised with their parents is even worse. Anyway, the charge in this case is a failure to provide basic needs or necessary parental care and control. We have an analogous statute here in Texas that relates to the neglect of food, shelter, or clothing needed by a child. In either case, whether this were in D.C. or Texas, these general neglect provisions do not require proof of harm. In other words, we don't have to prove that injury or illness has already resulted. We can act preemptively and intervene when we see circumstances that are likely to lead eventually to harm or illness. Let's advance to the next slide. Did the state prove deprivation? Courts frequently distinguish between the so-called snapshot case of deprivation versus persistent deprivation. Now, by snapshot, I mean a handful of cases that are discussed by the court's decision in In Re A.H., although I edited quite a bit of this out. The so-called snapshot cases are those in which the state attempted to prove deprivation based on a one-day visit at the parent's home. The snapshot proves only that the parent had a deprived or deplorable condition at home on a particular day. The difficulty with this is that parents will have lapses that may be short term. We've all had bad days. I don't think any of us is likely to have had a day as bad as this particular mother, but who knows? Maybe your time will come. You'll have one of those bad days, and your house will be a mess. If you visited me in my office, you know that I have some really bad days. In any event, that's not enough to prove the kind of neglect that is contemplated in these general ongoing deprivation cases. What the state has to prove is a persistent deprivation, and the question is, how did this district prove persistent deprivation? The answer is by making multiple visits over a prolonged period of time. The house just never gets any better. It's always in a really horrible state. Last bullet, health problems, if any, would be relevant. The state admits, rather the district admits, that the children didn't have any particular illnesses or injuries in this case, but it would certainly be another way of proving that neglect is persistent, because the conditions that were observed have continued long enough to have created some real health problems for the children. Let's advance to the next slide. Did the state prove causation? At first glance, it might seem that causation ought to be irrelevant. If we're trying to rescue the children, does it really matter why the parent has failed to provide adequately for the children? Shouldn't we simply intervene to rescue the children from an otherwise bad environment, no matter what the cause? The answer is that current thinking is that the state has an obligation to provide the means for being an adequate parent. And this includes, for example, subsidized housing, food stamps, aid to families with dependent children, and so on, Medicaid. All of these things can fill the gap between having nothing versus having barely enough to be a barely adequate parent. Thus, as we explained on Monday, the state has to prove either that the neglect was caused for some reason other than financial inability, or that services were offered but refused by the parent. Now, the burden of proof is on the state to prove that the cause was not financial inability. How can the state do that? Well, there are three or four ways of doing that. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, you could prove that there were deplorable conditions and you offered services and the parents simply refused to accept them. Now, it's their own fault if they weren't able to take care of their children. Secondly, you might prove that the parent actually had financial ability. That is, they had lots of money in their bank account, but they simply refused to use their resources to provide the basic needs of their children. Third, you might be able to show facts that show that neglect is due to non-financial causes. For example, in this case, the house is a real mess. A lot of the problems are based or the result of simple lack of action, simple lack of cleaning, simple lack of organization by the parent, which is not financial inability. A fourth way of proving causation is that the parent lacks the mental or emotional health to be a good parent. That's what I'm referring to in my very last bullet. This will, however, require expert testimony. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case and a lot of speculation that the mother suffers from gross depression, and that probably does, in fact, explain a lot of her inability to deal with her environment. The state didn't present a witness to actually testify to that extent, though, so that is simply not a strategy used here. Instead, the state proved that she was receiving sufficient amounts of social welfare benefits that she could, in fact, afford to provide for these children. It also showed that many of the acts of neglect were not really based on lack of funds. it was based on simple lack of cleaning and organization and initiative. Next slide. We begin another specific ground for termination now, abandonment and non-support. Hollick versus Smith, which is where we begin on our next slide, illustrates the problem of proving lack of support by a parent who has in fact arranged for some manner of support for her children. In this case, the mother, Mabel, is having a difficult stretch in her life. She has three children. She can't take care of that many children, particularly if she's going to move in with her boyfriend. She and her boyfriend haven't got much money, so she leaves two of her children with a niece, that's Mrs. Smith, who's married to Mr. Smith, and having left the children with relatives, she goes off to Dallas to make a new life for herself. In the meantime, it's certainly worth noting that the mom, Mabel, sends no money for the support of the children. She doesn't visit them for 6 months, although Dallas isn't that far away, although somebody with limited money can't really travel much. But perhaps more importantly, she's only had one phone call and zero letters or other messages or attempts at communication with these children. Next slide. You'll see in the next slide, abandonment and non-support, a sample of specific grounds. There are, as illustrated here, at least four different ways that you could prove abandonment and lack of support, but each has its own elements. Some things can make the case a lot easier, for example, if the parent left the children behind with another and expressed an intent never to return. That makes your case a lot simpler, but we didn't have that in this case. This was understood to be temporary. There was certainly no express decision by Mabel to abandon the children entirely. Anyway, the Smiths, who are now seeking to terminate so that they can adopt, they're going to rely on subpart C, which is in red. Did Mabel voluntarily leave her children in possession of another, that would be the Smiths, without providing adequate support and remained away for at least 6 months? Well, the big issue in dispute here is whether she failed to provide adequate support. Next slide, Hollick versus Smith, arranging care equals support. The question in this case is, what does it mean to have failed to provide adequate support? Do you actually have to send money to support your children? And the answer is no, assuming that you haven't been ordered by a court to send money. The fact that you arrange for proxies to take care of your children for you works. It's a way of supporting and taking care of your children. And I think we've discussed this problem before, where parents leave their children with grandma. That is, in fact, a way of taking care of your children. At least if the understanding between the parties was that there was not going to be any money. And the record in this case supports the conclusion that when Hollick went to the Smiths and left her two children with the Smiths, the understanding was that they were not necessarily going to be getting any money, that they were volunteering as relatives to take care of these two kids and were happy to do it. Obviously, the caretaker's expectations are important for reaching this conclusion. The bottom line here is that the court will not terminate Mabel's rights, Mabel Hollick's rights, because she did not fail to provide support for the children. She supported them by making arrangements with the Smiths. Next slide. Specific grounds. Incarceration. Can you lose your children because you have been sent to prison? Next slide. In re AV, can prisoners be parents? Well, in fact, something like 1.5 million parents are in jail right now. Probably the number's a little bit higher than that by now. And something like 700,000 children have parents in jail. In this case, you have a father who has been sent off to jail. He's facing 11 years of prison. Now, imprisonment per se is not abuse or neglect. His rights are not going to be terminated simply because he's been sent off to jail. After all, he has mother, right? Mom is at home and she's going to take care of the children. I think I've mentioned before, by the way, that you need to check this out with your criminal law defendants, when they're going off to jail, it's an important conversation to have with them, who's going to be taking care of the children. And when Pablo's on his way to jail, he assumes, of course, that mom will be taking care of the kids. But in this case, that was not a reliable thing to assume, because mom is a really lousy parent. The state intervenes, terminates her parental rights. She doesn't care. She doesn't resist. She doesn't appeal. She's out of the picture. So where are these kids going to go? And the state naturally intervenes and takes care of the kids. Now, the question is, has Pablo satisfied the requirements for termination under these circumstances? Here's what the statute says. Incarceration is ground for termination if it will continue, if it continues for 2 years from the date of the petition and the parent is unable to provide care. Now, this is another illustration of just lousy drafting by the legislature. When they used the word from, which is emphasized there, did they mean 2 years before the petition or 2 years after the petition? In this case, the court's going to conclude that from means for 2 years after the petition. Now, this provokes an argument between Pablo Puig and the state about what that two-year period really means. Is it 2 years before or is it 2 years after? Pablo says, look, the only fair thing to do is look 2 years back. In other words, when you file your petition, when the state seeks to terminate, we should be looking at what has happened in the last 2 years. Did I, in fact, fail to provide care for my children? It's not fair to look 2 years into the future because I might be let out of jail. I might get time off for good behavior. I might succeed in my appeal. Maybe the DNA lab will prove that it wasn't really me. All sorts of things could happen. The state, on the other hand, successfully argues that we look forward. We ask ourselves, will there be anyone to take care of these children for the next 2 years? In other words, we look prospectively. And this is the interpretation that the court adopts. After all, our goal is to protect children. And if we see children who are prospectively going to be abandoned without anyone to care for them, then that's important reason for intervention. We're not really seeking to punish the parent under these circumstances. It's just a way of taking care of the child. Again, the best interests of the child will be the ultimate limit on whether we actually terminate the parent's rights as well. Which takes us to our next slide, the best interest of the child. That's the ultimate pre-termination inquiry. If we're going to go to the extreme of terminating the parent-child relationship, in all of these cases, we also must determine whether the best interest of the child favor terminating that relationship, or perhaps the child's interests favor some lesser action. Next slide. The child's best interests, when do they really matter? Remember that they usually don't matter at all, and that will strike some of you as shocking, but it's the absolute truth. Remember the parental presumption. Until the parent's presumption has been rebutted by proof of unfitness or one of those other fairly narrow grounds, the parent has the prevailing right to custody and possession of the child. You have to prove unfitness before the child's interests become relevant. Comparative parenting skills are otherwise irrelevant. The mere fact that we could find better parents, for example, isn't enough. The fact that the child's existing parents are below average is not enough for us to transfer children to some other family based on the children's best interests. Remember the continuing doubt in Texas about the psychological parent theory. This is something that judges are still struggling with here. If children, for example, have grown attached to other de facto caretakers, we could argue that it's in their best interest that they remain in the families that they have become attached to. But as we've discussed, some judges are of the belief that natural or birth parent, the unrebutted parent's rights predominate here, even if that might result in some psychological or emotional harm to the child, all of which is a way of saying again that the child's best interests are less important than you might have thought. Finally, remember all of the cases we've discussed in which the parent asserts constitutional rights of religion or medical decision making, and parents are allowed to make some troubling decisions about how to raise or care for their children under the umbrella of First Amendment rights. And these are all cases in which arguably the parent's liberty interests have predominated over the child's best interests. Next slide. After presumption rebutted, child's best interests are key. Child's best interests come to the forefront once we've actually proven the ground for termination. If the presumption is rebutted, now the child's best interest does become the predominant issue. And this means that the child's interests will prevail over the parent's interest. This is not a balancing process, considering both sets of interests. We look, or we focus on the child's interests, not the parent's interests so much. Sometimes the child's interests will point toward termination. Sometimes they'll point toward some alternative action. There may be cases in which the child's best interests do not favor termination, even though the parent is deemed to have committed some offense that could lead to termination. And that may be because, for example, there's no better option for the child. Next slide. Holly versus Adams is a case where a father is seeking to terminate the mother's parental rights. This is a private action seeking termination. It's a pretty good illustration of why it is that the grounds for termination standing alone may not be sufficient to actually achieve a termination. The father is seeking to terminate the mother's rights here because he's remarried and he's suddenly very concerned that if he ever dies, the child will necessarily have to go off and live with his mother. And the reason that might be a bad idea is that the mother hasn't supported the child, hasn't been involved in the child's life. The stepmother, the father's new wife, has really become the child's de facto mother. And this will be a wrenching sort of consequence for both the stepmother and the child if the father were to die and the child were forcibly returned to the birth mother. Let me note in passing the alternative strategy under the current Texas Family Code. You don't really need to terminate the mother and have a step-parent adoption in a situation like this to protect the relationship between the child and the stepmother. Remember that the step-parent will now gain her own standing for a SAPSR suit. She can sue, therefore, for managing conservatorship in the event of the father's death. Anyway, that option was not available to the parties at the time of Holly versus Adams. Now, another important aspect of this case, which is omitted from the edited version, it's the question whether the mother failed to support the child if she wasn't really ordered by any court to provide child support money payments. And the answer is yes. You can have a failure to support even if your failure to provide money was not a violation of a court order. You simply have an ongoing obligation as a parent to support your child. But the real heart of this case is, assuming that we have proven the termination grounds, do the best interests of the child actually favor termination? Now, you can advance to the next slide, and I've listed there the so-called Holly factors, which are routinely cited by judges and lawyers in cases involving a decision about the disposition of a child's care, custody, and possession. I think you should look at these and get sort of a flavor from them. I don't think it's really important that you memorize all approximately eight of the Holly factors. Many of them will be inapplicable or irrelevant depending on the type of case that you have, and they're not exhaustive anyway. You could, in many instances, think of reasons why a child's interest might point one way versus another, and it wouldn't necessarily be one of the Holly factors, but it might still be relevant. So look at the Holly factors and get a flavor for them and understand how the child's relationships with the parties count, possible options for the child, what's going to happen if the child is actually terminated from that parent, what are the parent's respective abilities, is there already a pretty strong relationship between the child and the prospectively terminated parent. All of these things become important, and I'll leave it to you in your spare time to look at those factors as they are discussed in the Holly case. We're going to move on now to the next chapter, Jurisdiction in Family Matters. Where is the right court for a family dispute? Let's advance on to the next slide, Ankenbrand versus Richards. Can you make a federal case of it? In other words, does a family law case ever belong in the federal court? Next slide, Ankenbrand, are the federal courts family friendly? In this case, you have a kind of a family dispute. It's a tort action by the mother against the father and his new wife. She alleges some kind of abuse by the father / ex-husband. She sued, however, in the federal court based on diversity jurisdiction, which raises the question, when is it possible to invoke diversity jurisdiction and get your family law case before a federal judge? Now, the lower courts relied on the so-called Barber exception to diversity. The Barber case is an old U.S. Supreme Court case which seems to have assumed that in domestic relations cases of a certain sort, the diversity jurisdiction rule was inapplicable. In other words, you could never get such a case into a federal court even when there was diversity jurisdiction. The Barber court case was subsequently expanded from matters of divorce and alimony to any domestic relations matter involving husband, wife, parent, and child. Next slide, domestic relations exception, statutory, not constitutional. The point is that federal courts could easily have jurisdiction, diversity jurisdiction in family law matters, but for the fact that Congress has the authority to limit their jurisdiction. And to make a long story short for this podcast, it simply has come down to us over the past two centuries that the authorizing statutes do seem to limit the authority of federal courts to exercise jurisdiction over family law matters. There is a perhaps valid policy reason for this, and that is that many state courts, we should not think all state courts, but many of them do have lots of social services at their disposal. A family law courthouse here in Harris County, for example, is quite an operation. They have a complete staff of social welfare workers and experts who can assist the courts in family law matters. Federal courts don't, and Congress has never appropriated funds for the federal courts to have that kind of service, and we would have to come up with that money as taxpayers if we were going to allow for such cases to proceed in the federal courts. Next slide, special grounds to abstain from federal jurisdiction. It turns out that the federal relation exception is something that only applies to matters like divorce, alimony, child support, and child custody. The mere fact that a lawsuit is between family members, even if it's a tort action, doesn't really bring it within the domestic relations exception. Thus, this tort claim could properly be brought in a federal court based on diversity jurisdiction. There are, nevertheless, two other reasons why a federal court might abstain from exercising its diversity jurisdiction. One is called Younger abstention, where a federal court proceeding might interfere with some ongoing state lawsuit. Imagine, for example, there is a divorce between the parties. We've talked before about the fact that divorcing spouses in Texas can now assert tort claims against each other. Could they have one divorce action in the state court at the same time that they're pursuing a tort claim in the federal court based on diversity jurisdiction? That might be an occasion for so-called younger abstention. The argument would be that allowing the tort claim to continue in the federal court would interfere with the divorce action in the state lawsuit. Secondly, there's Burford abstention. Will the federal courts exercising jurisdiction in this case interfere with the development of state policy or state findings if, for example, some tort claim or contract claim depended on a determination about the existence of a marriage? A federal court might want to abstain from exercising diversity jurisdiction to allow state courts and state officials to make the additional findings that could be necessary about that family. Next slide. We have a problem here. Wanda Widow's former companion Joe has died. She wishes to apply for Social Security survivor benefits on the ground that she was Joe's common-law wife. But Joe had a wedding with Sue after he separated from Wanda, and Sue has filed her own claim for benefits. Must the Social Security Administration and a reviewing federal court abstain? That should be from deciding Wanda's or Sue's marital status. Well, a couple of things might happen. Number one, there might already be some kind of probate proceedings going on, in which case there might be an occasion for younger abstention. We need to put a hold on this federal court litigation and federal administrative litigation until we have some resolution of the state court proceedings. Secondly, we might have Burford abstention, where the court or the agency will want to put a hold on the proceedings to encourage the party to resolve their issues in federal, or rather state agencies and state courts. Let's go on to the next slide now, problems of personal jurisdiction. Next slide is background dissolution versus incidence of divorce. There's a lot of history that we could talk about with respect to divorce law in the United States. I'm going to try to make this podcast short. We have recognized today that there are, in fact, three bases for jurisdiction. There is, as you learned in civil procedure, personal jurisdiction. There is in rem jurisdiction. And now we're going to be talking about status jurisdiction. Status jurisdiction is a court's jurisdiction to adjudicate a party's relationship with the state or with other people, such as by marriage, parentage, or citizenship. Status jurisdiction is based on a party's domicile. We look at the place where the party has their domicile. Now, domicile is not the same thing as residence. In theory, you can only have one domicile, but you can have more than one residence. Some of you may be residents of Texas, even though you are domiciliaries of other states. If you still think of Florida as your family home, for example, but you come to Texas to go to school, we could say that you are a resident of Texas while you're a student here, but you're ultimately a domiciliary of Florida. For purposes of status adjudication, the place to go is your domicile. And therefore, Texas would not necessarily be the place to go if you were merely a resident but not a domiciliary here. Now, here's the curious thing about divorce jurisdiction. You need domicile to establish the basis for jurisdiction to adjudicate one party's status, such as by declaring them to be hereby an unmarried person. Obviously, that affects a second person, the person being divorced from. But here's what the courts have decided, to make a very long story short. Due process does not require status jurisdiction over the respondent for dissolution. As long as the petitioner is a domiciliary of the state where he or she is seeking his or her divorce, that's sufficient, even if the respondent is not a domiciliary of that state. So we only need status jurisdiction over one of the parties. That takes us to Dawson-Austin versus Austin. This is a case that illustrates the point. You have two parties who live arguably in other states, but one of them really wants to have his divorce in the state of Texas. Probably it's because he's learned from advice of counsel that Texas has better property division rules for him than some of the other possible choices for state jurisdiction. Anyway, he plants some property here in Texas, and eventually then he's going to sue for divorce in Texas, claiming that he's a domiciliary of Texas and that Texas should have jurisdiction to adjudicate the divorce. Next slide. Dawson, Austin versus Austin, are property issues severable? In this case, Bill Austin succeeds in persuading a court that he's now a domiciliary of the state of Texas, and he does file for divorce here. His soon-to-be ex-wife, Cynthia, makes a special appearance. She does this to challenge property division, but not dissolution of the marriage. Now, she doesn't challenge the dissolution of the marriage because that would be pointless. Bill, the husband, is entitled to sue for divorce wherever he happens to be a domiciliary, or he could have sued where she is a domiciliary. In any event, as long as one of them is a domiciliary here, the petitioner can have a divorce. But at the same time, she can claim that as long as she's not a domiciliary of the Texas, and there is state of Texas, and there's no other basis for personal jurisdiction over her, that's all the state court can do. It can only dissolve the marriage. Status jurisdiction doesn't give the court the authority to address the other incidents of divorce, such things as property division or alimony. Now, this, at first glance, seems to raise a practical problem, because the general rule is this: property and children's issues are not severable from dissolution. In other words, if you're going to seek a divorce, you have to do everything else at the same time. But there's an exception to this general rule. The exception applies when the court in which we are seeking dissolution doesn't have jurisdiction for these other matters. In this case, a Texas court could make a status adjudication. It could dissolve the marriage and treat these people as now being unmarried. But for the other incidents of the divorce, the property division, and any children's issues, we would need some other basis for exercising personal jurisdiction over Cynthia. Thus, Section 6.308 says that a court is to adjudicate the part of the divorce as to which it has jurisdiction. Which brings us to our last slide for this podcast. Is there jurisdiction to divide property? Well, as I've said, property division requires personal jurisdiction over a respondent, that would be Cynthia. She's not a resident of Texas. Texas was not the last marital residence within the past 2 years. There are no other minimal or minimum contacts, and Bill's own unilateral purchase or transfer of property to Texas is not enough to make Cynthia within the personal jurisdiction of the state of Texas. And we will say more about this when we begin again here on Monday. This is the end of this lecture.